IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Sunday, November 20th, 2022. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University, and here is our first story. Changes to Parade Magazine. Parade Magazine, which had been inserted into newspapers across the nation for decades, recently discontinued its print publication and moved exclusively to an e-edition product. Its final print edition was published in last Sunday's print edition of the Daily Nonpareil. Of course, all print and digital subscribers of the Daily Nonpareil still have access to Parade's weekly electronic magazine on our e-edition platforms. But there's more to the story. Starting with today's print edition, the Daily Nonpareil is proud to offer a brand new weekly print edition page that will include some of Parade's best content, the same content you've loved for years. Not only does the new offering include Parade's cover story for the week, it also includes a fun and challenging numerical puzzle called Numbrix. This enhanced content partnership between the Daily Nonpareil and Parade is meant to ensure that you, our loyal readers, continue to receive the best that Parade has to offer inside our printed newspaper, as well as within our e-edition products every week. Thank you for supporting local journalism by way of your subscription to the Daily Nonpareil, and we hope you enjoy the new Parade page, as well as the new Parade e-edition magazine found on B4 of today's edition of the Daily Nonpareil. Next, we have Winterfest Celebration Brings Holiday Spirit to Bayless Park. Attached is photographs of children and families having fun outside with cold weather and Christmas lights. Ashley Palin Left and her daughter Haley Smith IV check out the holiday lighting display at Bayless Park during the annual Winterfest celebration on Friday, November 18, 2022. Mayor Matt Walsh, Santa, and Mrs. Claus led the crowd through a rendition of Jingle Bells before counting down the lighting ceremony. Free Christmas-themed activities sponsored by the Council Bluffs Public Library, the 712 Initiative, Union Pacific Museum, and Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment were available in and around the park. Kids got a chance to mail letters to the North Pole, meet Santa, watch animated Christmas movies, and more over hot chocolate. Food trucks were lined up to serve food, and people got in the holiday shopping early at the Maker's Village. Next, Christmas tradition returns. A treasured Council Bluffs tradition is returning soon as the historic General Dodge House prepares for its annual Christmas at the Dodge House celebration. The interior of the Victorian mansion is, quote, 100% ready to go, and exterior holiday lights will be illuminated at 6 p.m. on November 29th, according to Executive Director Tom Emmett. Quote, the general ladies do the decoration, and then different florists, organizations, and families come in to decorate the trees, Emmett said. Members of the Iowa Western Community College basketball team also helped put things up this year, he said. As always, there will be more than 20 Christmas trees on display and decorated for the season, 16 in the Dodge House and 6 in the Barisham House, he said. The theme this year is Hometown Christmas. Many past visitors will return to see the holiday splendor, Emmett said. Quote, we get quite a few this time of year, he said. Families who have made the Dodge House a tradition for generations will come. They came as a kid, and they will bring their grandkids. Hundreds of lights will light up the exterior when they are switched on November 29th, Emmett said. Quote, it can be seen from the expressway, he said. It's really something for the community to be proud of. The Dodge House will hold several special events, including the holiday season, including the following. Family Night, 5 to 8 p.m., Thursday, December 1st. Santa will be there to greet visitors and pose with children. Visitors can make a Christmas ornament in the Barisham House and then tour the Dodge House and enjoy cookies and cocoa in the ballroom. Admission will be $15 per family. Breakfast with Santa. Seatings at 10 and 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, Saturday, December 3rd, Santa will await visitors in the ballroom, and the night before Christmas will be read. Craft activities will be held in the basement, and children can pose with Mr. Claus and his sleigh outside. The cost is $15 per person, and children aged 2 and younger are admitted free. Registration is required and closes December 1st. See dodgehouse.org. Regular hours of the Dodge House in December are Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Thursday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday, 1 to 5 p.m. The last admission is 1 hour before closing. The Dodge House is closed throughout January for cleaning and maintenance. Now to our next story, tax money for schools. Legislature, interest groups prepare for renewed private school scholarship push. Legislation addressing taxpayer-funded private school scholarships is likely to make a comeback in the next Iowa legislative session. Proponents of the policy say that they hope to see an expanded version of what was passed in the Iowa Senate during this year's session. Senate Republicans passed a bill that would have made up to $10,000 in scholarships available to students to attend private schools or charter schools. The scholarships would have been available to families making up to 400% of the federal poverty line and students with an individualized education program, generally students with disabilities or special needs. The proposal would have seen around $55 million diverted from public schools to fund those scholarships, according to estimates from the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Proponents of the policy say that it gives parents more choice over their children's education and would help students who don't succeed at public schools, while others argue it would hurt public schools. Keeping taxpayer dollars in public schools would help the largest number of children. The measure failed to pass in the last legislative session in the House, where around a dozen Republicans did not support it, in many rural districts who are concerned about the policy's effect on schools in their area. Democrats in both chambers opposed the measure. The bill was one of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' flagship policies proposals during the last session, and she campaigned this year on bringing a similar measure back in next session. A spokesperson for the Reynolds says she will reveal her legislative priorities in her annual condition of the state address once the legislative session starts, and she will, quote, never give up on providing children with the best learning environment that they deserve, end quote. The legislative session will start January 9th, 2023. The legislative landscape. House Republicans will create a new education reform committee in the upcoming session, which will deal with, quote, bills containing significant reforms to our education system, according to a press release. Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley of New Hartford, who will chair the new committee, didn't say whether it would consider a private school scholarship bill. Quote, the House Republican caucus plans to consider a broad set of education reforms this session, end quote, he said in a statement. The new committee will allow these important issues to be put in front of the entire caucus for the in-depth discussions they deserve, he continued to say. Both chambers also passed bills during this year's session dealing with transparency in education, which would require schools to publish course materials and lesson plans online, but the legislation stalled amid disagreements over private school scholarship proposals. In the Senate, where the proposal has been passed the last 2 years with less dissent among Republicans, Majority Leader Jack Whitaker said it is too early to know exactly what will be in a Senate bill dealing with private school tuition assistance. Quote, I expect to debate policies similar to the bills Senate Republicans passed in 2021 and 2022 sessions, allowing parents to choose to use scholarships to send their children to the school that best fits their needs, he said in a statement. Democrats are expected to oppose those measures if they come up in the next session. Quote, Iowans don't care if a new committee in the Iowa legislature is created to consider the government's voucher plan or other bad ideas, like jailing teachers and banning books, because it's all politics, House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist of Windsor Heights said in a statement this week. Quote, House Democrats stand alongside Iowans and will oppose any bill that shifts money from public schools to private schools. It's time to put people over politics. Advocates push for expansion. Advocates for this policy said their, quote, gold standard is to see a system where any family can use funds that would go towards a child's public school for private schooling or homeschooling, rather than a limited number that was proposed in the last session. While Iowa Republicans may not go that far this year, advocates say they expect to see a proposal that will expand on what Senate Republicans passed this year. Quote, if I was going to guess, and I haven't seen a bill, it'd be more than $10,000. Chuck Hurley, Vice President and Chief Counsel for the conservative Christian organization, The Family Leader, said. It'd be pretty expensive, because I think the governor is on a mission to try and help more parents. Trish Wilger, executive director of the Iowa Advocates for Choice in Education, said the formation of the Education Reform Committee in the House was a sign that House Republicans will make progress on the issue. Quote, "We aren't certain of the intent for the committee or how education and education reform will work together, but we are optimistic that it means the House is very serious about education issues, including school choice," she said. But not everyone is expecting an expansion of the measure. Margaret Buckton, a lobbyist for the Rural Education Advocates of Iowa and the Urban Education Network, both of which oppose the scholarship bill, said she would be surprised to see a proposal larger than what the Senate passed last session. Mike Bernick, president of the Iowa State Education Association, the union that represents teachers and educators in Iowa, declined a request for an interview because specific legislation had not been proposed. But in an email statement, he said that the ISEA would continue opposing diverting public school dollars to private schools. Quote, "Iowa's public schools continue to heroically serve their communities, students, and families, and public dollars need to go to public education," he said. "Spending vital taxpayer money on private school vouchers when our public school needs resources to address the needs of nearly 500,000 students attending them is harmful to Iowans in every community across the state." Opponents of the idea say public opinion is on their side. In an exit poll conducted by public policy polling for the liberal advocacy group Progress Iowa, 54% of respondents who voted in the November midterm said that they think public tax dollars should go towards public schools only, while 39% said some students should be able to use the dollars for non-public schools. Counting the votes. Well, with a new class of Republican legislatures, it remains to be seen whether there will be enough support in the House of Representatives to pass the legislation. Reynolds threw her support behind primary challengers to 9 House Republicans that didn't support the measure in this year's primary election, and several of those incumbents lost in the primary. Notably, Representative Dustin Height, a Republican from New Sharon, who chaired the Education Committee and opposed the measure, lost his bid for re-election to primary challenger Helena Hayes. There has been some changes in who's in the seats in the Republican majority. The Republicans will have a larger majority as well, Wilger said. And we believe that school choice supporters are among those new faces in the House, so we are optimistic. On the other side, Buckton said she's optimistic opponents can convince legislatures of the harmful effect they say private school tuition assistance would have on public schools in Iowa. Quote, "When you get to actually looking at the policies and hearing from constituents about their feeling about it, I think it's not going to be a done deal at all," she said. "I think there will be a lot of good quality conversations." Now for our next story. Walz and Garriott elected to lead Iowa Senate Democrats. Iowa Senate Democrats re-elected Senator Zach Walz to serve as Senate Minority Leader and elected Senator Sarah Trone Garriott to serve as Minority Whip for the upcoming legislative session. Quote, "I'm honored by the trust my fellow Democrats have placed in me as we fight for middle-class families," Walz said in a press release. Walz, of Coralville, was first elected to the Senate in 2018 and named the chamber's Democratic leader in 2020. He is a vice president at Green State Credit Union. Trone Garriott of West Des Moines was first elected in 2020 and was elected again this year after redistricting, defeating Republican Senate President Jake Chapman. She is a Lutheran minister and a coordinator of interfaith engagement for the Des Moines Area Religious Council Food Pantry Network. Trone Garriott is succeeding Amanda Reagan of Mason City as Minority Whip, who retired this year after 20 years in the Iowa Senate. Iowa voters did not give Republicans a mandate to sell out the middle class, wreck public schools, and strip away basic rights, Trone Garriott said in a press release. "Senate Democrats will stand up to Republican overreach and give Iowa families a voice in our government." The caucus elected Nate Bolton, Des Moines, Eric Giddens, Cedar Falls, Pam Guchum of Dubuque, Herman Querbach of Ames to serve as assistant leaders. House Democrats re-elected Jennifer Confrist of Windsor Heights to serve as minority leader and Lindsey James of Dubuque to serve as minority whip in the House this last weekend. Democrats lost seats in both chambers of the legislature after November's elections. They are slated to hold 16 seats in the Senate, while Republicans will hold 34. With two-thirds of the chamber, Republicans will be able to prevent Democrats from blocking gubernatorial appointees that require a two-thirds majority. Walz said in the release, Senate Democrats will continue to defend economic opportunity and fundamental rights. Quote, Republicans are politicians, meanwhile, offering the same old extreme and unfair agenda, rewarding big corporations over middle-class families and attacking Iowans' personal freedom, he said. Republicans elected their leadership last week shortly following the midterm election. Jack Whitfer of Grimes was reelected as Senate Majority Leader, while Amy Sinclair of Allerton was elected Senate President, succeeding Chapman. Now for our next story. Iowa Dems caucuses getting fair hearing after rough start. At first, Scott Brennan was not sure if Iowa was getting a fair shake. When the National Democratic Party announced its plan to re-examine the order in which states pick the party's presidential candidates, Brennan, an Iowan and a member of the National Party's Rules Committee, felt like the National Democrats simply sought to punish Iowa for the 2020 caucuses when the program was designed to report results malfunctioned on caucus night. Quote, when the process started, it seemed like it was a lot of folks looking for a pound of flesh and retribution for failures in 2020. Brennan said Friday, while recording this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. With a decision on Iowa Democrats' first-in-the-nation status imminent, the Rules Committee is scheduled to meet in the first week of December. Brennan said he now feels like the case Iowa Democrats are making to remain first are being heard and given a fair hearing. Quote, I think we've gotten a fair hearing, and now we're working whatever angles we have, Brennan said. Iowa Democrats and Republicans have been the first to cast presidential nominating preferences every 4 years since 1972. While Iowa Republicans will once again go first in 2024, Iowa Democrats' spot is up for grabs, with the National Party reconsidering its nominating calendar. The National Democratic Party's Rules Committee voted in April to reopen its presidential nominating schedule, forcing all interested states, including the current early voting states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, to apply to be included in the party's early presidential nominating window. Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico that applied for an early voting spot. National party leaders have said early voting should feature states that have primary elections and not caucuses, have diverse populations, and are competitive states during presidential elections. Iowa does not fit that mold at all well. It nominates presidential candidates via caucuses, not primary elections. It has the sixth lowest minority population in the United States, and Republicans have dominated Democrats for the past five elections here. In order to address the caucus concerns, Iowa Democrats propose a dramatic overhaul to the presidential caucus system, which will make it much more similar to a primary election and address many of the accessibility concerns expressed by caucus's critics. Brennan, who is also a former state party chairman, was asked during the Iowa Press recording whether National Democrats are giving fair consideration to keeping Iowa as an early voting state with its proposed changes, or whether national leaders' minds were made up from the start to bump Iowa from its envied first-in-the-nation perch. Next, we'll go on to our next story, Face of the Day. Our Face of the Day is actually a dog. Bruce the dog is an old, loving dog, and pups and cats like him are just $50 this week only. Bruce is a male senior rat terrier mix who is currently available for adoption at the Midlands Humane Society. Shelter staff members say he is a friendly, affectionate, gentle, and funny, and that he loves kisses. When adopted, he will have a microchip, age-appropriate vaccines, and will be neutered. Midlands is currently at capacity with cats and dogs, and they're having a sale this week to help clear some kennels ahead of the holidays. All cats and dogs, and 1 year and older, are just $50 through November 6th, including Bruce. The shelter will be closed on Thanksgiving, but animal lovers are invited to swing by from noon to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday and 11 to 5 p.m. on Saturday. More information about fostering, volunteering, and donation opportunities can be found at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org or by calling 712-396-2270. Like their Facebook page to keep up with daily shelter news. The shelter can also be found at Midlands Humane Society on Twitter and at Midlands Humane Society on Instagram. Next, we'll go on to our next section, Week in Iowa. a recap of news across the state from the past 7 days. In the news, House GOP adds Education Reform Committee. Iowa House Republicans are adding an Education Reform Committee in the upcoming legislative session. The measure comes as Governor Kim Reynolds is expected to continue a push to shift millions in taxpayer dollars to private school tuition assistance. The committee will deal with bills containing significant reforms to our education system, Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley, who will chair the committee, said. Legislators are also considered bills in this year's session that will continue to require schools to post course materials online and prohibit obscene material from school libraries. Iowans weigh in on Trump presidential bid. Iowa politicians endorsed by former President Donald Trump kept him at arm's length after he announced a third run for president this week. Senator Chuck Grassley and Representative Ashley Hinson both said they encourage all candidates to come to Iowa to make a pitch to voters ahead of the 2024 Republican caucuses. Trump is the first Republican to announce his candidacy for 2024, but several others, including former members of his cabinet, have been testing the waters for presidential campaigns and were frequent visitors to Iowa ahead of the midterms. A Des Moines Register and MediaCom Iowa poll from October found that 52% of Iowans said that their feelings towards Trump are very or mostly unfavorable. In the news, senators split on marriage bill. Republican Iowa U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley were split in a vote Wednesday on a bill that would codify same-sex and interracial marriage at the federal level. Ernst voted for the proposal, while Grassley voted against it, citing religious liberty concerns. The bill passed the Senate with support from 12 Republicans, including Ernst. Senators included an amendment that ensures nonprofit religious organizations will not be required to provide services to accommodate a same-sex marriage. Scott County completes recount. Scott County completed its absentee ballot recount on Friday after multiple recounts and issues tabulating results. The county performed a machine recount on Tuesday and a hand recount on Thursday, and a final machine recount on Friday of more than 23,000 absentee ballots. The Iowa Secretary of State's office called for a recount last week after an administrative issue was found. The recount resulted in the lead flipping a Scott County House race, where Democrat Craig Cooper came out ahead by only 6 votes after the recount. They said, quote, "I'm honored my colleagues have trusted me to lead the RGA as we work to ensure voters in Louisiana and Kentucky are given the same chance at a better future, and Mississippi gives Governor Tate Reeves the second term he's earned." This is from Republican Governor Kim Reynolds after being elected chair of the Republican Governors Association. Another quote, "Iowans don't care if a new committee in the Iowa legislature is created to consider the governor's voucher plan or other bad ideas like jailing teachers and banning books because it's all just politics," Democratic House Leader Jennifer Confrist on new Education Reform Committee. Odds and ends. Agencies manage infrastructure cash. This week marked 1 year since the passing of the federal infrastructure law, which dedicated more than $1 trillion to projects for road maintenance, airports, waterways, broadband, and more. The law resulted in a 30% increase in the Iowa Department of Transit's 5-year project plan, allowing local governments to fund more projects on roads and bridges. Iowa airports have received $51 million, and more than $113 million has been dedicated to drinking water safety. Kim Reynolds takes RGA chair. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will lead the Republican Governors Association after being elected to the post this week. Reynolds, who handily won re-election last week, was the vice chair of the organization. Reynolds will lead the group's fundraising efforts as they look to elect candidates in the 2023 gubernatorial elections in Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. The water cooler. COVID hospitalizations drop. Iowa COVID-19 cases ticked up slightly in the week ending on Wednesday, with 1,980 new cases compared to 1,863 the previous week. The number of people hospitalized in the state with the same virus dropped in the same time frame, from 180 to 137. Google settles with states. Iowa will be paid more than $6 million in a multi-state settlement over Google's location tracking practices. the tech giant settled for $391.5 million, with 40 states this week, the largest tech security settlement with U.S. states in the U.S. history. House Dems re-elect leaders. Iowa House Democrats re-elected State Representative Jennifer Confrist of Windsor Heights as Minority Leader and Representative Lindsey Janes of Dubuque as Minority Whip this last weekend. This week, Senate Democrats re-elected Senator Zach Walls of Coralville to be Senate Minority Leader and elected Senator Sarah Torn-Garriott of West Des Moines as Democratic Whip. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 20th, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Next, we'll read the obituary section from this past Sunday and Saturday. Sue Ann Schuster. Sue Ann Schuster, age 63, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 16, 2022, at her residence. Sue was born August 4, 1959, in Hokkaido, Japan, to Daniel and Elizabeth Nelson Love. Sue worked many years in the banking industry. She is preceded in death by her mother, Elizabeth, in 1977, and her son, Corey J. Schuster, in 2007. Sue leaves behind her daughter Erin Mann and husband Ryan, son Matthew Schuster and wife Madeline, grandson Hudson Corey Schuster, father Dan Love, and wife Lou, sister Kathy Riedemann and husband Jeff, all of Council Bluffs, brother Scott Love and wife Deb of Bellevue, Nebraska, sister Chrissy Grew and husband Scott of Elmhurst, Illinois, nieces, nephews, and many, many friends. Visitation with family, Tuesday, 6 to 8 p.m., funeral service Wednesday, 11 a.m., all at funeral home. Family will direct memorials. Fellowship will follow at Lincoln's Pub and Jefferson's Lounge. Marilyn M. Lustgroff. Marilyn M. Lustgroff, age 80, passed away November 17, 2022. She was born April 25, 1942, to the late Henry and Emma Hansen in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Marilyn graduated from Underwood High School with the class of 1960. She was a member of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Trainer. Marilyn is survived by her husband, Jerry Lustgroff, children, Amy Hansen and Dustin Lustgroff, grandchildren, Gerhard Hansen, Lucas Lustgroff, Abby Lee Lustgroff, Hannah Lustgroff, and Emmeline Hansen, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kanalski Funeral Home on Monday, November 21st, 2022. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Trainer on Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. Interment is in the Hazel Dell Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the Trainer American Legion Lamar Hartship Post 725 or St. Paul Lutheran Church in Trainer. Robert A. Paschek. Robert A. Paschek was born on September 20, 1946, to Doris and Arthur Paschek. He grew up on the family farm outside of Creston, Iowa. He graduated from the Prescott, Iowa Community College in 1964. Bob then completed studies at the Commercial Extension School of Commerce in Omaha and began working for the Union Pacific Railroad Home Office in Omaha, Nebraska in 1965. Bob was inducted into the United States Army, interrupting his employment, and began his tour of duty in Frankfurt, Germany. After his honorable discharge, he returned to work for the railroad in Omaha until his retirement in 2006. Then, while back to work in Omaha, he purchased a historic home in Council Bluffs, Iowa, which had been converted into 6 apartments. He had a vision to completely restore the house to its original condition when it was built in 1877. He began the task by getting the now Tully's Mansion on the National Register of Historic Places by the United States Congress. He was exceedingly proud that he had achieved his dream prior to his passing. Bob's passion for his house opened the door to his interest and knowledge in flowers and gardening. He had a fine eye for landscaping and lavish placement of color on flowers in the yards, complementing the Victorian structure with a slight hint of French influence on the back patio. Although his job involved a great deal of travel in the Northwest, he never grew tired of it, and it fostered his desire to continue to travel during his retirement to destinations in the South, to visit plantations and to visit the Northeast coast, to visit Maine and eat lobster. He liked his job, but even more, he loved his coworkers. He kept in touch with many of them during his retirement up to his last days on this earth. Left to mourn Bob's passing are his spouse, Bill Mann of Council Bluffs, Iowa, his cousin, Deborah Comer of Oakland, Iowa, two cats, Molly and Emma, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and very close friends. He was described by those who knew him as a beautiful, kind soul. Services Wednesday 10 a.m. at Marr Funeral Home. Visitation is Tuesday 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Interment is at Soldier Valley Cemetery in Pigsgah, Iowa. Memorials to the Midlands Humane Society. Marvin K. Dutch Madden. Marvin K. Dutch Madden, age 93, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 17, 2022, at his home. Dutch was born May 15, 1929, in Griswold, Iowa, to the late Frank and Ella Culver Madden. He married Marion L. Birch on February 28, 1949, in Neola, Iowa. They were blessed with five children, Dennis, Jacqueline, Kenneth, Leroy, and Diane. Dutch worked for the Rock Island Railroad for 8 years. From 1951 to 1895, he worked for Union Freightways and PIE. He coached for many years for the Playground Club and Midget Leagues in Council Bluffs. From 1972 to 1999, Dutch and Marion had a cabin in Minnesota where they spent a lot of time with family. Dutch was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church and the Teamsters Union Local number 154. In addition to his parents, Dutch was preceded in death by his wife, Marion Madden, in 2021, five sisters, two brothers, and two half-brothers. Dutch is survived by his children and their spouses, Dennis and Ruth Madden, Jacqueline and Monty Stork, Kenneth and Michelle Madden, all of Council Bluffs, Leroy and Cheryl Madden of Ducoin, Illinois, Diane and Dan Brown of Council Bluffs, 15 grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Wake service Tuesday 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer, Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian burial Wednesday 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church. Interment Memorial Park Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center at 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorial contributions are suggested to all Thomas Jefferson Athletics. Ruth Ann Collins Fitcher. Ruth Ann, born Collins Fitcher, age 77, passed away November 27, 2022. She was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa, on June 25, 1945, to the late Russell and Elizabeth Schmidt Collins. She retired from Harrah's Casino from the bakery department. Ruth enjoyed living on the farm in Missouri Valley and spending her time tending to many farm animals they had. She also enjoyed a good yard sale, reading and playing games on the computer. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, John Fitcher, her sister, Linda, and brothers, Gary Collins and Russell Collins. Ruth is survived by children, Tim Deal Fitcher and Wendy, John Fitcher II and Michelle, Jolene Huerta and Sam, siblings, Orville Collins, Patton Irv Rowland, Brian Collins, sister-in-law Betty Gardner Hyman, brother-in-law Frank Fitcher, grandchildren Ashlyn Decker, Lynn, Ben, Nick, and Cammy McKenzie, Savannah, Dallas, Johnny III, Kaylee, Ashley, Tyler, Brianna, Hodo, Daisy, Jamie, Javier, Adriana, Kaylin, and great-grandchildren Harper, Henry, Riker, Rylan, Wesley, Opal, Jackson, Gabriella, Luca, Colin, Tessa, Talia, and Cadence, nieces, nephews, and a host of other family and friends. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoyokilnoski Funeral Home on Wednesday, November 23, 2022. Interment is in Fairview Pioneer Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Those were all of Sunday's obituaries, so now we'll read the ones from Saturday. DJ Michael Myers. DJ Michael Myers, age 27, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 15, 2022, in Omaha from serious injuries suffered in a car accident. DJ was born November 3, 1995, in Council Bluffs to Jennifer Myers and David Holmes. He graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 2013. DJ was an equipment operator in the construction field. He is survived by his children, Delaney Myers and Corbin Kluick, and their mother, Sierra Borja, mother, Jennifer Holmes, father, David Holmes, grandmother, Carolyn Myers, sister, Rebecca Myers, Deanna Ribeiro, Melody Goh, brother, Travis Holmes, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, cousins, and many friends. Visitation with the family, Monday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Memorial Gathering Tuesday, 11 to 3 p.m. at the Elks Lodge, 380 Mackenzie Avenue, Council Bluffs. The family will direct memorials. Blanche Evelyn Riley. Blanche Evelyn Riley, age 92, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away November 14, 2022. She was born on June 8, 1930, in Omaha, Nebraska, to Harvey and Esther Hulbert Beck. She is survived by her husband, John. No services planned. Next, we'll go on to read the opinion section for the day. Gun warnings need deeper investigations. Concern about students accused in killings should have promoted more worry and action. The University of Virginia has a program aimed at preventing on-campus violence. The program's name is Just Report It. Someone did report Christopher Darnell Jones Jr., the University of Virginia student accused of killing three of the school's football players, badly wounding a fourth player, and wounding a fifth student less severely last Sunday. What the university now must address in the wake of a horrific mass shooting is why its violence prevention and threat assessment system could not stop the crime. A student told school authorities in September, 2 months before the crime, that he had heard that Jones had a gun. The allegation was made during an investigation of a hazing event that involved Jones. The person offering the tip had not seen a weapon. Neither had Jones's roommate. Jones refused to cooperate with school authorities. That refusal continued after school officials discovered Jones received a suspended jail sentence for a concealed weapon violation in February 2021. So the threat assessment team emailed Jones October 26th, asking him to cooperate and warn him that he faced the prospect of discipline if he didn't. The step came too late. 16 days later, Jones allegedly murdered football players Deshaun Perry, Devin Chandler, and Laval Davis Jr., and seriously wounded another player, Mike Hollins. Jones also allegedly shot a female student. Nothing that happened before the killings kept Jones off a bus filled with students who went to see a play. Sunday afternoon. When the bus arrived back on campus Sunday night, Jones allegedly opened fire. Authorities have offered no motive for the crime. Jones appears on the school's 2018 football website as a player. The difficulty of intervening with an uncooperative person is significant. It is a razor's edge balancing act between stopping potential violence and violating civil liberties. According to the list of recommended practices for Virginia College threat assessment, no one can be detained against their will without having a, quote, mental illness and a substantial likelihood that he or she will cause serious harm in the near future. Legal experts interpreted near future to mean within 1 week. The University of Virginia must examine its actions after it discovered that Jones had a concealed weapon. That knowledge combined with the tip that Jones told someone he had a gun, as well as Jones's refusal to discuss anything about a firearm. Those alarms signaled the need to act quickly, press much harder, and worry much more. Understanding that a student involved in hazing and gun investigations, including a weapons conviction, might demand more intervention than the routine threat of the student disciplinary process affords is a good starting point for looking at policy changes. Going forward, the rest of us must also treat everything involving guns and schools as urgent and deadly serious. As the University of Virginia learned tragically last Sunday, firearms offer no margin for error. Now for our next opinion. Independents may not like Biden, but they abhor Trump. I thought I was taking crazy pills on the set of CNN's Election Night in America show on November 8th, leafing through the pages of exit polls just before the returns started rolling in. Nearly half of the country said they are worse off than they were 2 years ago. Three quarters said they believe the nation's economy was not good or poor. Inflation was the top issue, and 79% of Americans said they faced hardship from it. Almost 75% said they were dissatisfied or angry about the way things are going in the U.S. Democratic President Joe Biden, unpopular, at just a 41% approval rating. His policies, also unpopular. 47% thought they were hurting the country, versus 33% who said they were helping. A sour, angry electorate showed up at the midterm election polls, according to the data. They should have been punished in the party in power, especially the independent swing voters among them, who made up a third of all voters. That would have matched similar trends in 2006, 2010, 2014, and 2018 midterms. And yet, the swing voters didn't swing that way at all. Independents broke slightly for Democrats nationally, 49% to 47%, and they sided with Biden's party even more decisively in key Senate contests. In Georgia, independents went for Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock by 11 points over Herschel Walker. In Arizona, Democratic Senator Mark Kelly won them by 16 points over Republican challenger Blake Masters. In Pennsylvania, Democrat John Fetterman won them by 20 points over Republican Mehmet Oz. As an election night wore on, it became clear that though independents in 2022 may not love Biden, they absolutely abhor Donald Trump. And in each of those three states, the Republican Senate candidates shared a characteristic of being a subsidiary of Trump. If Biden's low approval rating is low, Trump's favorability is worse, sitting nationally at 39%. He is hugely unpopular, and his brand continues to taint Republicans who haven't built their own identities. In Georgia, the incumbent governor, Brian Kemp, won independents over Democrat Stacey Abrams, even as Walker was losing them. Kemp is known for having stood up to Trump after the 2022 election and withstanding a Trump-backed primary challenger. Kemp is his own man, and he was rewarded for it. Several Republican governors have figured this out. In 2021, it was Glenn Youngkin who won state election in Virginia, a state Biden had won by 10 points just a year earlier. This year, governors Mike DeWine in Iowa and Ron DeSantis in Florida developed their own identities and were rewarded with big wins. Republicans need to finally learn the lesson. Trump is not a majority maker for himself, his adopted party, or for most of the candidates he picks. He backed into the presidency in 2016, winning fewer votes than the most unpopular Democratic candidate in my lifetime. He cost his party the House in 2018 and the Senate in 2020. He lost the White House in 2020 and has virtually no path back to it in 2024, based on the 2022 midterm results. Trump will never, ever command a majority of the national popular vote. He is a loser, according to the empirical evidence. Trump has never been weaker politically than he is now, or at least since the disgrace of January 6, 2021. Republicans should have moved against him then, but they hesitated, allowing him to recover and dominate the GOP for another 2 years. When the void exists, they must be filled. 2 years ago, there wasn't a clear alternative to Trump. But now, Republicans can see the next lily pad. DeSantis, coming off his victory, might be that Trump alternative, with Trump seriously weakened by the midterm results. Now is the first time for the younger of the two Floridians, and the party that adores him will take advantage of it. Will Trump go down without a fight? No, of course not. He has many advantages. Tons of money, a team that fully depends on him for their livelihood, and a committed group of supporters for whom politics is more a religious experience than a path to achieving governing authority. Discerning Republican voters shouldn't cower or give in. After all, a majority of Republicans tell pollsters that they are more loyal to the party than the former president. If they mean it, they should think hard about what it takes to appeal to independents. If they want their party to return to power, they should find a new nominee in 2024. This opinion was written by Scott Jennings, who is a former special assistant to President George W. Bush and a senior CNN political commentator. He wrote this for the Los Angeles Times. And for our last opinion of the day, election shows most parents content with public school. Over the past 18 months, a vocal and vigorous collection of community members alleged school districts peddled smut in their libraries, blasphemed U.S. history in their classrooms, and incorporated liberal dogma in their policies. They commandeered local school board meetings and warned board members to expect rebellion at the ballot box as parents sought dramatic change. Turns out most parents prefer a few tweaks to total transformation. The primaries and recent general elections confirm something that rabid public school critics won't admit. Most parents like their public schools. No, parents don't think their schools are perfect, but they are not in favor of scorched-to-the-earth reform. In a Gallup poll conducted in August, parents with children in K-12 expressed overall contentment with their child's education. When asked about their own child's education, 32% said they are completely satisfied, 48% somewhat satisfied, 14% somewhat dissatisfied, and 6% completely dissatisfied. Given all the attacks on how schools responded to COVID-19, it's noteworthy that 80% of parents, either completely or somewhat satisfied, exceeds last year's tally of 73%. That rate also exceeds the average of 76% since Gallup began asking the question of parents 2 decades ago. School board contests essentially upheld the status quo in Metro Atlanta, with incumbents returned to office. In national races, many candidates who co-opted Republican Glenn Youngkin's successful playbook from the Virginia governor's race last year of blasting public schools didn't prevail. In his victory address after besting a Trump-supported Republican opponent who advocated decreased education funding, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said his goal was a state where books are not banned nor children are shielded from truth about all of our American history. Voters in Michigan re-elected Governor Gretchen Whitmer, rejecting an opponent who pledged to rid their schools of an anti-American vibe. In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers prevailed over Trump-backed Republican Tim Michaels, whose refrain was, "We are going to stop the CRT and get back to the ABCs." In Colorado, Governor Jared Schultz police defeated a school choice advocate who falsely accused Colorado schools of accommodating furries, students who identify as cats, with litter boxes. Among those responsible for spreading this wild tale was Colorado GOP Representative Lauren Boebert, whose narrow lead over Democratic opponent Adam Frisch may go to a recount. National Education Association President Becky Pringle said, "Parents and voters explicitly rejected extreme politicians who engaged in the politics of division, politicizing our classrooms, banning books, dragging their culture into our private schools, and punishing their failed privatization schemes." There were exceptions, most notably Florida, where voters awarded a big win to Governor DeSantis despite his frequent portrayal of Florida schools as hothouses of liberal dogmas, his passage of the Don't Say Gay bill. Nor did Georgia Governor Brian Kemp seem to suffer from his endorsement of politically driven legislation limiting how race is discussed in K-12 classrooms and banning transgender girls from competing in girls' sports teams. He easily rebuffed Democratic challenger Stacey Abrams. After his primary battle with Trump candidate David Perdue, Kemp didn't ballyhoo his support for these controversial measures as such, taking up instead his $5,000 teacher raise and his second-term goals to focus on learning loss, recruitment and retention in education, and school security. Lisa Morgan, president of the 25,000-member Georgia Association of Educators, said it was likely a strategic decision by Kemp to sidestep the culture war controversies. 4 years ago, he laid out his education plan around a teacher raise. Now he was able to keep his promise, Morgan said. He didn't talk about the culture war issues and was able to keep out of that conversation out of the forefront. Yet, to be known whether the conversation will return to the forefront when a new Georgia General Assembly meets in January. This opinion was written by Maureen Downey. Downey writes for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, AJC.com. Now let's go on to our last section of the day, sports. We are the champions. Reavers shut out Bruins for second national title. And Schwimmer wins tournament MVP. The Iowa Western women's soccer team has won its second national championship in the program history. The Reavers beat Salt Lake College 1-0 in the NJCAA Division I championship game in Evans, Georgia on Saturday evening. "It feels great. It's an awesome feeling," Reaver coach Adam Sanchez said. "These players have played an awesome tournament over these past four games, brought them into everything we told them, and just believed we could do this. We played very difficult teams. I think we had the toughest path to the final of any team, but they just overcame the challenges and adversity and rose to the top." The Reavers had some early chances with 13 total shots in the first half, but the Bruins held them off. But finally, in the 13th minute, Martin Lopez booted a penalty kick to put the Reavers on the board. "The ball was right there in front of the goal. We kept kicking at it, but instead we got the penalty shot," Lopez said. "I just walked up and sent it in, and it felt like a lot of weight lifted when it hit the net." Meanwhile, the Reaver defense held the Bruins to just two shots against the first half. Against a team that had solid offensive success, Sanchez was pleased how the Reavers shut down the Bruins and limited their chances. "They didn't have any clean looks on goal, and I thought our defense really stepped up," Sanchez said. "We struggled early this season to get a shutout, and now to get it done in the national championship is a testament to these girls. The back line played great, but the front six really worked their butts off to deny any looks to the Salt Lake's front three and made it very hard to get anything through. Just a really good overall team performance. It wasn't our prettiest match by championship matches rarely are. As we told the group, championships aren't meant to be played, they're meant to be won, and they did what it took to win." The Bruins came out with a fast start and held the ball on their attacking side of the field for the front half of the second half. However, the Reaver defense still limited the shots on goal to six in the second half with some great defense and superb goalkeeping by Bella Washington, who had five saves, kept the Bruins scoreless, and led the 1-0 victory. "It's absolutely amazing being here with my family," freshman forward Hannah Schimmer said. "This team really is my family. Even over the tournament, our connection grew, and we fight for each other. Overall, it's just amazing, and we're crying, and we're so proud of each other, and we made it all happen. We just kept telling each other that we can do this," Lopez said. "We know it was going to be hard, but we made it here, and now we've won nationals and are bringing home a trophy." During the award ceremony, Hannah Schimmer was named the NJCAA Tournament MVP. Schimmer scored three goals and had an assist through the tournament's four-game stretch. "The whole team was just screaming for me, and I'm so happy right now," Schimmer said. "It feels good, but this national championship, this took the whole family, and to hold up the trophy, this is the best." After starting the season with one win, three losses, and a tie, the Reavers have now finished the season with 18 consecutive wins. "Coming back from is another testament to how they've brought in and their belief in each other," Sanchez said. "You can see it when we take the field and these girls, how much they care for each other. And I think that's the main thing that we carried through was their willingness to push for themselves, for each other, to fight for each other, and to never give up on each other." The Iowa Western finishes its second national title in program history with a 19-3-1 record. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 20th, 2022. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Annika Hurd from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening and have a great week.